Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, my name is Kristen Turner, and this is New Books in Music, a podcast of the New Books Network. Today, I'm talking to Norm and Carson Cohen, two of the editors of An American Singing Heritage, songs from the British, Irish, American oral tradition as recorded in the early 20th century, published by AR Editions in 2021. It's the 32nd volume of the Music of the United States of America series. These are scholarly editions designed to provide performers and researchers with definitive editions of music from a wide variety of traditions, from symphonies by George Bristow to jazz compositions by Mary Lou Williams. Norm and Carson worked on the massive project with the late Andrew McLucas. This collection of 100 songs is a record of a fundamental repertoire in American music. Brought to this country by colonists, the folk songs became one of the foundations of the genre that early record executives called hillbilly music, which was eventually rebranded as country music. Each song has extensive notes explaining the piece's background and text, information about the recording used for the musical transcription, and a list of secondary sources that discuss it. Thank you so much for joining me today, Norm and Carson.
Happy
pleasure to be here.
So, unfortunately, your third collaborator, Andrew McLucas, passed away fairly early on in this project. And before we start talking about the project itself, could you tell us a little bit about Dr. McLucas?
Sure. Ann McLucas was a folk musicologist at the University of Oregon for many years. She was chairman of the department at the time that she passed away. Her interests included not only folk music, but also classical music and jazz and other varieties. And she was an accomplished keyboard player as well.
And did she, my understanding is that she recruited you, Norm, for the project. Is that correct? Was she sort of the lead in the initial, coming up with the idea?
Yeah, this was all her idea to begin with. And we had met just a few times before that at meetings, and I had visited her at her home and so on. And the whole project was her conception, and she wanted somebody to help her with it.
And then my understanding is that after she passed away, Carson, that's when you became involved?
Yeah, that's right. I never met Anne. I just in passing asked my dad once what's his latest project that he's working on, and he told me about this book and about what happened to Anne and that she was doing the transcriptions. And I asked, well, so is the project on hold? And he said, for the time being. So I said, well, if you just need transcriptions, maybe I can help. And that's how that happened.
Well, it's certainly an amazing project. And let's start by just sort of explaining the repertoire and sort of how the project works, I guess. And so the first thing is that this is a massive repertoire of folk songs, but you only chose 100 pieces. So maybe we could start with how were those 100 songs chosen? Maybe Norm, you could start with that.
Sure. Well, you know, we had lurking in the back of our minds is the notion of most popular folk songs, but that's kind of an oxymoron in a sense. First of all, there's no quantitative way to measure popularity when you're dealing with an oral tradition. With pop music or other forms of music, there are some tangibles that you can go by, you know, sheet music sales or recording sales or number of times listened to or played on radio programs and so on. But with an oral tradition like folk music, you just have none of those possibilities. So what we had to do was try to imagine that we want to get the selection, the 100 songs that one would be most likely to hear if one were in these folk communities where the music thrives and is still current. And how to do that, how to obtain a proxy for that, was our first challenge.
So how did you do that? How did you figure that out?
Okay, so I said, let's look at the various places in which the folk music has been captured. That is to say, field recordings by professional folklorists, recordings of traditional music in other venues, publications in folk song collections. So basically, we took all of those and started looking, tallying up the songs that were most often collected either orally and then and recorded or published. So the combination of the two, publications and recordings.
Well, the other thing that occurs to me is, so there's, you know, figuring out what's popular, but then also, how did you work out what the limits to this repertoire was? I mean, you've called it British, Irish, American. What exactly does that mean? Why use those three country designations
that? In other words, we wanted to separate out African-American music and other ethnic American musics, such as Polish-American, Yiddish-American, and German-American, and so on, simply because that just casts such a wide net that we would never get done. So we limited it to English language music in the Anglo-American Irish tradition, with the exception of one recording that we used by an African-American performer.
And you said that you were looking at recordings, both commercial and recordings that were recorded for commercial by folklorists. Yes. And maybe I'll ask Carson this question. And of course, Norm, you should chime in. But it occurred to me that a folklorist like John or Alan Lomax, who I know collected many of these, and a commercial recording by Decca or something, the people that were recording them and the ways that they recorded that are very different. You know, those commercial recordings, they would herd people into a room and start recording them in a hotel someplace. And the Lomaxes were much more likely to be sort of in somebody's home or something like that. So do you think that where it was recorded and the reasons for which it was recorded made a big difference? Did you see that as changing the recording or changing the purpose of the recording made things something more or less suitable for this collection?
Well, I can't imagine that it wouldn't make a difference. But really, that's more my dad's sort of area of expertise. So I'll defer to his answer.
Yes, it does make a difference. It's more straightforward with the folklorists like the Lomaxes, such as you mentioned. I mean, they did tour around. They would visit a community. They would generally have prearranged. They would have set up sessions by talking to the local folklorists or the local people who knew who was a good singer or performer in that community, and then they would go visit them. The commercial recordings, and we're talking about commercial recordings from the mid-20s to the mid-1940s, started out, this was a new musical genre, recording traditional performers in Appalachia and the Ozarks and so on. And that whole genre started out because the recording industry was looking for new types of music. They saw that they were being threatened by radio, by movies, by other forms of entertainment, and they wanted to broaden their audience. They determined to broaden their audience by broadening their performers. So they would initially, they would advertise in local newspapers, you know, we are sending, Victor Talking Machine Company is going to have some field recording engineers and so on set up in such and such a hotel or such and such a location. Anybody who is interested in making a recording, please come at such and such a time. And so you got traditional performers who were really piqued, who were really curious about the notion of going and making a recording. So initially they were recording performers who had very little commercial experience. And these folks would come in, record their handful of tunes. They'd be sent off. And if the recordings were really interesting or good, then the company might contact them and ask them if they cared to come back. So over the period of a decade or so, they started out with completely non-professional, and it gradually weeded itself down to those who were interested in continuing a sort of a semi-commercial career. So by the end, there wasn't that much difference. It was more similar to what, the difference between the commercial and the non-commercial became less clear-cut.
So as these singers were sort of, as you said, were weeded out to the ones that were more interested in having a commercial career, did you see them changing the music to conform to what they assumed a commercial audience wanted? Or do you think that they were really just singing the music that they knew from home and they weren't making any particular changes to it?
The ones who continued to perform were very significantly affected by the recording process, because, you know, if you're just singing for your home community somewhere in some rural Tennessee or somewhere, your neighbors are going to want to hear you sing your favorite songs over and over, and you will become known for those songs and they'll become associated with you. Once you step into a commercial studio and record that same song or those same songs, you don't need to record it again for them. So if you want to continue this relationship with the commercial company, you're going to have to find other songs. And so you'll exhaust your own repertoire, perhaps, and then maybe you'll start writing some songs or finding newer songs. So gradually, you know, that there is a change. The commercial recording artists who made that transition most blatantly were people like Jimmy Rogers and the Carter family. I mean, they started out like all the other non-commercial musicians, performers. They had a very local career, but then with the recordings, they became very, very popular, and there was a demand for more and more material. So what they didn't already know, they would start writing songs or turning to other people to write songs.
So how did you tell the difference between, you know, sort of what they wrote, new songs they wrote, and these older traditional songs? Well, you know what I'm saying? Like, if it's all in the same style, how did you get to the point where, well, this is clearly newly composed by Jimmy Rogers?
Well, what we were interested was the oral tradition. So after a point, and that happens around 1940, 41, 42, they're not recording traditional songs anymore. All the material, it's moved from hillbilly music, which is still a fairly traditional genre, to country western or country music. And it's mostly a freshly composed genre.
And so, go ahead.
Well, at that point then, to go back to a previous question, we focused on the traditional music of the first half of the 20th century, because you can't take an open-ended time period, because the music is going to be changing constantly. So we said, let's focus on the first half of the 20th century, and we'll take recordings and material that's been collected, say, from the early 20th century to the mid 20th century also.
So you mentioned that when, before it was recorded, these singers would have been singing them for their home communities. Where were these home communities? Did you have a specific geographic area that you were looking at?
We tried very hard to get material that represented as much of the United States as possible. And the challenge there is that, for example, with the recordings, the hillbilly recordings, that's almost exclusively southeastern United States. And we didn't want to limit ourselves to that. So you turn to published collections. And there is a substantial body of material collected in New England, in the Southeast, somewhat less in the Southwest and Midwest, and even less in the Far West. But we did the best we could to try to represent all regions of the country.
Carson, I'd love to pull you into this conversation for a moment. I know you did the majority of the musical transcriptions. Can you talk a little bit about, so it sounds like you didn't choose the recordings yourself. Did your father tell you which ones? So what were some of the challenges of actually transcribing these pieces?
Well, I would imagine they're the same challenges that most people encounter when they try to transcribe these types of recordings. For one thing, just the recording quality, you know, often makes it hard to pick out, say, is that a guitar or is that a banjo? You know, especially if there's, you know, in some cases there is a number of players playing and they're all kind of playing the same thing. So there's that. There's also things like, you know, say a song sounds like it's in A, the key of A, but anyone who, you know, plays guitar can tell that the guitarist is actually playing a G. So, you know, is his guitar just tuned up? Was the recording equipment not calibrated right? Was the digitization wrong? For whatever reason. So in a case like that, I chose to transcribe it the way the guitarist played it in G in that example. You know, and also, you know, being that these players and singers are not trained at all, often their rhythms and the pitches are pretty indistinct, or, you know, they're sort of in between the spaces, in between the notes, in between the beats. And I definitely struggled a lot with how precise to be. I mean, I wasn't, you know, when I started, I didn't have any really background in folk music. So I was just jumping in and transcribing it, sort of trying to do it as literally as possible. And then more and more, I started to wonder what the value was of being so exact and so precise. When you're dealing with music that isn't precise, I mean, the performers weren't thinking of it that way. You know, if they had one bar of 7/8 in there in a whole song, that wasn't an intentional necessarily decision on their part. That's just sort of, you know, the way they felt it. So, and there were times when it made sense to do it very precisely like that. And there were times when it didn't seem to make sense. And so that was sort of my main struggle, was just walking that line between extreme accuracy and, you know, imagining that I understand their intention and transcribing what I thought that might be instead.
This is a problem that other musicologists dealing with folk music have you know, torn their hair out about. People like Percy Grainger and Cecil Sharp, Charles Seeger, men who are trained in classical music and now are trying to transcribe recordings of traditional singers, realized, and some of them said specifically, that the more accurate you make the transcription, the more difficult it's going to be for anyone to read or to try to duplicate. So, you know, they faced the problem that Carson ran into. You have to compromise between accuracy and performability or the equivalent.
Okay, we're going to have to stop because now Carson can't hear anything. Carson, you still can't hear us? What the? This is new for me. I've never had this kind of problems before.
Wow.
Can
I can hear you.
Okay.
I can hear you now.
Okay. Right. Now I can hear you. Okay.
That was very weird.
My external speaker switched on its own to a different output.
Okay. That's very bizarre. Okay. No, it's fine. So I just let your dad finish his question so that we could cut the recording more easily.
Sure.
So, all right. So that's done. So, let me pick up. I was wondering, you know, so Norm, you were talking about how many people who've transcribed this repertoire have dealt with similar problems that Carson was talking about. Like, how exact are you? This is music that's not really designed for Western notation, and you're trying to stuff it into Western notation. Because we have access to these recordings, why did you feel that it was important to create a scholarly edition of this music that includes a musical transcription, since in large numbers you can find these recordings in various archives as well as out on the internet in the wild. So what's the value of having a scholarly edition of this repertoire?
I think that was really, Anne should be here to answer that question, because this was her conception, but she did things. Her plan, which we carried out, was to transcribe not only one stanza or one of a song, but to transcribe an entire song, because she felt there would be nuances and variation that would be lost if you just recorded one stanza, which has always been the common procedure with transcribing folk music. She felt that there would be a great deal more revealed by transcribing every stanza. I think in retrospect, and Carson can comment on this, I think there turned out to be less variation than I would have expected. Was that your feeling also, Carson?
Yeah, definitely. Some of the songs were almost identical from stanza to stanza. In fact, I was only just recently thinking that possibly comparing a single stanza from different recordings might have been an interesting way to go, to see different, the interpretations by different people, rather than just one person's how one person's interpretation changed during the course of a single performance, especially given that performance was probably never performed that same way again.
Yes. Yes.
I'm sorry, Norm. Let me just ask, that also brings up the issue of, like, how did you choose which recording?
Okay. We wanted to do several things. First of all, we wanted to have to include a number of recordings that were not commonly available. When we started out the project, I would say half or two thirds of the material was not would not have been accessible to most people. Secondly, we wanted, as I mentioned before, we wanted to represent the entire country. In other words, not just the Southeast, where most folk music recording has been carried out. We wanted to get examples from all over the country if we could. Secondly, we wanted a balance between male and female performers. And we talked a little bit about that in the introduction, about how there's somewhat of a difference in the gender balance between the commercial recordings and the field recordings. Field recordings tended to find more women. Commercial recordings tended to find more men. Those were some of the factors that we wanted. And we wanted just to represent a variety of styles. So smooth singing, very rough singing, singers that we thought represented the best of a tradition, and sometimes singers that were just very idiosyncratic and would show push the boundaries a little bit. So we try to, to make a very broad covering of traditional music.
So before we turn to some examples of particular songs. I wonder if you could, Norm, you can talk about text maybe, and then Carson about the music. Did you find, first of all, in the text, are there, I don't know, trends that you saw in the music? Did they tend to talk about sort of the same topics? Like, can you give us just sort of an overview of the textual elements of this tradition?
There was the most popular songs, that is the ones that turned up most often and therefore are at the top of our collection, tended to be, first of all, ballads. In other words, story songs. I think it was a common finding of people who did collected songs that in American folk tradition, stories are important. And those were the songs that were most often encountered, recorded, transcribed, and so on. So all the top 20 or 25 or so are ballads, songs that tell a story. As you get down toward the not quite so popular, there are more songs that were dance songs, songs that accompanied banjo and fiddle tunes, and more sentimental type pieces. So there was that trend. I guess I would ask Carson then to comment on any musical trends.
Well, when I was doing the transcriptions, I didn't really have in my head a good, and I still don't, a good idea of you know, which songs came from which region or were from what era. So I didn't really make any associations that, oh, all the ones from Texas have this, you know, and all the ones from the South have that. I guess I can't really say that I did. There was, in terms of the lyrics, I mean, I always knew that there was a lot of borrowing of phrases and verses from one song to another, but I guess it was a lot more than I was aware of. Also, just how often, you know, they're sort of singing about the same thing, the same story, you know, the man who kills his girl, for example. You know, there's probably at least 10 of those in this book. Go ahead.
There were quite a few, and yes, you're right. Songs about the murdered sweetheart was a very common theme in American traditional balladry, you know, all through the 20th century. We had several. Some of them were came from England, and some of them were songs that originated on the continent, but that was definitely the most popular narrative theme in our song collection.
I think actually the thing that was most interesting to me from reading your text about it was how, you know, a lot of these the lyrics were sort of censored when they got to the United States because of the puritanical sort of attitude we had here. And whereas if you go back and look at the way they were in Europe, they were more explicit and would, you know, and so sometimes there's sort of a mystery in the United States version as to why something happened. And once you realize that they would cut out certain elements of the story, you know, that then that makes it much more confusing when you try to understand what happened and why.
That's a good point. All the songs about the murdered sweetheart, any details of the sex or the violence or the fact that she became pregnant, American singers tended towards squeamishness on all of those counts, and so if they were explicit in the British ballad to begin with, they got lost in the versions that ended up being recorded in the United States. So, as you say, there was sometimes you'd get a story of a murder, and there's no and the uninitiated listener has no idea why the murder took place. He or she doesn't know that there was a pregnancy involved, and that the male decided to murder her rather than to marry her. And so sometimes you'll get and added a word or two suggesting that she wasn't faithful to him or he was jealous of something else. So motives changed in these ballads.
Do you have any idea of when they were actually performed, sort of, you know, in a community setting, in somebody's home or you know, at a party or whatever? Would they have told the story so that the audience understood the murder ballad in a different way than we might hear the murder ballad coming just as a recording by itself or just in this edition by itself? You know, like, I guess I'm asking sort of what did people know about these ballads?
Well, they undoubtedly had a more complete sense of the story than was explicit in the song. So they wouldn't have needed to be told the motives. These were ballads and songs that they grew up with, heard in their community over and over again, and elements that, you know, that were not explicit, they would have understood. And so when that song then becomes recorded as a commercial hillbilly recording distributed nationally, other audiences are available, the song, the meaning of the song is not as explicit to them. Yeah. So, yeah, that's a change that happens, you know, over time.
And also, I guess the difference between consuming this as hillbilly music on the radio that you enjoy and have it be the music of the tradition that you're actually growing up with.
Yeah, well. And there's another kind of related point here, and that is that those performers who started out being traditional, non-commercial, and then started to enjoy a thriving career making recordings, like a Jimmy Rogers, like a Carter Family, and others, you know, in our own time, people like Doc Watson, they will start to modify their repertoire because they begin to sense that their audience has a different, you know, comes from a different place and responds to different types of things. And so they will, the material will change as a result. That's the respect in which the recordings have not only documented the tradition, but they bring about a change in it.
Are you talking about changing, a few words here and there? Because I know I read something that you wrote about how people would change, you know, like from, you know, this, you know, say if they mention a river, they change it to a local river. Or are you talking about, you know, dropping a song completely and doing a repertoire that's exclusively appreciated by the region?
Well, I think both. Mm-hmm. I think they learned, you know, all good performers, regardless how commercial they are, will respond to their audiences. You know, they'll get some feedback from the audience. Mm-hmm. And if they're really trying to create a professional career for themselves, they will be very motivated, I should think, to adapt their repertoire to what goes over best. Mm-hmm. You know, so little changes as well as big changes. Can I tell a little anecdote in here?
Absolutely.
Back in around 1963, at an early folk festival at University of California in Berkeley, one of the performers or one of the acts was the Blue Sky Boys, a traditional pair of brother act from who grew up in North Carolina, very popular in the 1930s. And then they were sort of, quote unquote, rediscovered in the 60s. You know, they were not lost, but as far as commercially, they enjoyed a second career. And so they appeared at a number of folk festivals. So at this particular one in Berkeley, they sang a song, Down in the Willow Garden, which is one of these murdered girl ballads. And in this ballad, the murder takes place, but not only does the villain or the protagonist try to drown his sweetheart, he also beats her with a stick from a fence, and he does other things to him. So there's a series of violent acts that are performed there. And it's all sung in a very straightforward, undramatic fashion. And as he started to, the singer started to go through this litany of abusive treatment, the audience starts to titter and laugh, and they don't know quite how to respond to it. And this is a college audience now. And so by the end of the song, Bill Bollock, one of the singers, you know, pauses for a moment and he speaks back to the audience. And he says, I know that to you, you know, some of these songs may sound a little funny or a little weird, but we took them very seriously where I grew up, and we had a very different attitude toward them. So it was an example of a very perceptive traditional performer seeing how different his urban audience responded from his rural audience that he grew up with.
You said that you tried to have, you know, men and women singers that you were pulling recordings from. Did women sing these, you know, very violent murder ballads as well, or was that something more likely to be sung by a man?
No, they would sing them, but they might not sing any songs that had where the sex was too obvious, or body songs. Or they might sing it for women in their community, but would not sing it for a male folklorist who was making the recording.
Right. So these murder ballads, do you interpret them as being sort of cautionary tales to keep everybody in line, essentially? I mean, why do you think they were so popular?
I guess there were different reasons in different communities. But I guess that could have been a reason, but I think that there was also just the element of, if they really wanted to dwell on, to make them cautionary, I think they would have not wanted to eliminate some of the violent, explicit violence. It would have been more effective that way. So, you know, I don't think that was the only reason. I'm sure it was a contributing reason.
You know, it is easy when you hear something over and over, you sort of become desensitized to what the words really are. You know, they're just, you know, it's like Ring Around the Rosie or something. You don't really think about, well, this is actually right. Super violent. Like, you know.
Right.
So, yeah. Right. Yeah. Well, we do have a few, before we started this interview, we talked about maybe listening to a few of these ballads or excerpts from them and talking about them specifically, just to give our listeners a sense of this repertoire and the kinds of issues that you were thinking about. And I think we'll start. You have two different versions, I guess. It's all one number. If someone is listening to this that actually has the book, it's number 11. And it's called Tom Sherman's Barroom and St. James Hospital. So I'm wondering, why did you pair those two together in the first place?
Well, even though this is a nominally Anglo-American Irish tradition, it's very hard to just turn your back on the influence of the African-American tradition as well. And some of these songs turned up in African-American tradition. And one of the things that we thought was interesting was to look at one song that had made that transition to African-American, and to look what happens to the ballad when that transition takes place. So this was our one example of a song with two different versions of it. Carson pointed out that in retrospect, it might've been more interesting if the whole collection had done more of that, you know, and we certainly thought about that at one point, but that was just a decision that we made very early on. And once we made that decision, it was hard to go back on it. But this was an example that was just, we felt too good an example to not make use of. So maybe Carson can talk about some of the musical differences in the two.
As I rode down to Tom Sherman's barroom, Tom Sherman's barroom one morning in May, 'twas there I spied a gay handsome cowboy, all dressed in white linen, as cool as a clay. I knew by your outfit that you were a cowboy. That's what they all say as I go riding along. Come gather around me, you said, a jolly cowboy. And listen to me, comrade, said he. It's each and all my line and take warning and quit your wild roving before it's too late. It is once in the saddle I used to go dashing. It's once in the saddle I used to be gay. First taking to drinking and then the card playing. Got shot through the breast and now I must die. Go bear the news gently to my gray-headed mother and whisper them lowly to my sister so dear. And don't forget the word that I've told you, for I'm a gay cowboy and I know I've done wrong. So beat your drum loudly and play your fife slowly and play dead marches as you can.
All right, so that gives us a sense of what that song is about. Can you talk a little bit about the text there, Norm?
Yeah. Some singers may recognize, or some listeners may recognize in that the Streets of Laredo, a cowboy song that was quite widely known. And you, some may also recognize in the, after, especially after we play the next one, the St. James Infirmary. These are both very widely different versions of the same, basically the same story and the same ballad. And these two recordings that we've chosen also are two very different versions of the same story. So Dick Duvall, the singer of that recording from Oklahoma, was a traditional singer. He happened to have recorded both for the Lomaxes and also for RCA Victor when they were doing some of their hillbilly recordings. This particular recording was actually a commercial hillbilly recording, one of the very few that was ever made a cappella. So it's interesting to compare that particular version with the African-American one, which is also sung without accompaniment.
Can you just tell us what that story is? Since we didn't listen to the whole song, we can't really get a sense of that.
The original story is going back to the British Isles, is the story of a young soldier who contracts a venereal disease and dies, but in the course, as he's dying, gives instructions for his funeral. He wants soldiers to accompany his coffin. He wants pretty maids to be singing, to follow along. Bunches of roses strewn over the coffin so they won't smell the corpse as it goes by, and so on. So that ballad came to the United States and became a cowboy song. And we talked before about how certain elements get lost in the crossing of the Atlantic. The fact that it was a venereal disease does not appear in this ballad anymore. In fact, it turns out that he's dying because he was shot in the breast by another cowboy. So that's one good example of how these songs have changed when they come to the new world.
So Carson, listening to the music, mm-hmm. is there anything in particular that jumps out at you as being notable or unusual or very similar to other songs that you worked on?
Well, the couple of things that stood out to me are, you know, this, one thing, it's transcribed in E minor, like E Dorian with two sharps. But it could have just as easily been E Mixolydian because there are a number of G sharps in there where it does the major third, almost as many as the minor third. So that kind of could have gone either way. And it doesn't seem to be consistent in terms of, you know, where that happens. You know, it isn't always the major third in the third stanza and always the minor third in the fourth stanza or anything like that. And in the first line of each stanza, there's no third at all. It skips the third, which is a sound that I always like. In fact, it reminds me of the sawmill banjo tuning where they tune the third up to the fourth. So yeah, it goes from the the root to the second to the fourth to the fifth, da 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 da, with no third at all. So it's ambiguous in that regard from the beginning. And it also has a thing that I have heard in a lot of these tunes where it has this sort of suggestion of being kind of modal rather than diatonic. And that's the way that in the third line of each stanza, it almost modulates to the four. I can't take me to the graveyard, that part, where it ends the phrase on the four chord, which stands out to me. And again, it's something that I've heard in a number of these songs. None of this is something that I could say relates specifically to the text or other versions or other tunes. It's just the things that stand out to me listening to it right now.
Let's listen to the other version. This is by James Ironhead Baker. It does sound quite different. So let's give that a listen.
One morning month of May, when I looked in the window and I spied a dear cowboy wrapped up in white linen, he was cold as a clay. Says, come, dear mother, seat yourself now, me. Come, dear father, to and sing me a song. For my knee bones are aching, and my poor heart is breaking. Well, I know I'm a poor cowboy, farther than I know I've done wrong. Six young gamblers, Papa to balance my coffin. 16 young hogas, father sing me a song. Tell them to bring along a bunch of them sweet smelling roses. So they can't smell me while they drive me low. Well, in my saddle, father, I use a good dashing. Father, in my young days, when I...
Can you quantify perhaps some of those differences that we're hearing? Maybe we'll start with Norm so Carson can think some more.
Well, Baker's version is more in the spirit of African-American folk song in the degree of freedom in his, you know, rhythm and so on. Typically, Anglo-American singers were much more metrically oriented, although the Tom Sherman's Barroom is an example where there is more variation in rhythm than you typically hear. It was really surprising that recording was issued by RCA commercially, because it's very different from what typical hillbilly song recordings were like in the late 1920s. So, that always struck me, but we liked it partly because it is an unusual performance, and it is, I think, a very dramatic and effective way of telling that story.
Carson, what are your thoughts?
Well, hearing them back to back like that, I actually am seeing much more of a similarity than I saw before, just in terms of the general shape of the melody, although the St. James Hospital is very clearly in a minor key. There's nothing ambiguous about it, like there was in Tom Sherman's ballroom. But the contours of the melody are actually are similar. And this also does have that same thing where the penultimate phrase of each stanza emphasizes, I think for the only time in the stanza, the natural sixth of a degree of the scale, which gives the impression of the four chord, the subdominant. So that's in both of them. So yeah, like I said, they're sort of more similar than I had previously realized.
So do you think that this is a good example of the ways that the effects of segregation on the thinking of recording executives who would say, well, this is a white singer, here's a hillbilly song, here's a black singer, this is a blues song. We see that, you know, in real life, they were talking to each other and playing for each other and knew all the same repertoire, but that's not how it gets disseminated in a commercial aspect. Would you say this is a good example of how the sort of musically how that works?
That's a very complicated question. there is no, it is certainly true that the recording industry segregated performers and they marketed them differently. Recordings by white artists were sold in white communities. Recordings by black artists were sold in black communities. And it was a distinction that was pretty rigid commercially, but not at all among the performers themselves. There were a few examples of a commercial recording of a black artist who sounded so white that the company released it, you know, in the along with the hillbilly music, and vice versa. A few white singers who had a very effective African American style, as perceived at the time. Now our notions today are very different from what they were, you know, 80, 100 years ago. I mean, I know that there were African Americans who thought Jimmy Rogers was black based on his recordings. And there are other, you know, other examples of that too. So yeah, the race issue is very complicated. There were a couple of string bands that had both black and white performers, but when they took studio photos of them, for example, they'd leave the black ones out. So to the unknowing audience, these were white hillbillies. There was no notion that this was an integrated, you know, string band.
Yes, we certainly can't get away from the effects of segregation on music, even in a collected edition that is trying to really focus in on notes and texts. That's always going to hang over our music industry and the way that music develops, I guess, in the U.S. as well. So very interesting example there. For one last one, let's move to The Two Sisters, which is number 28 in the in this collection. This is, I guess it's one of the child ballads. Can you explain what a child ballad is, Norm?
So Francis James Child was a ballad scholar in Boston at Harvard University in the late 1900s. And he became the preeminent scholar in terms of the collecting and analyzing of these, of a collection of Anglo-American ballads that some of them date back to the 15th, 16th centuries, and some of them from the 17th, 18th, 19th centuries. So he made this collection of what he thought were all the traditional ballads in the Anglo-American oral tradition. Turns out there were many others. But anyway, his analysis of these ballads and discussion of them played such a large role in the scholarship of folk music that his, the way he categorized them and numbered them became sort of a standard for collectors in the century afterwards. So you would identify a song as being child ballad number 20, regardless of the fact that it had 20 different titles and different performances, but the ballad number would make everybody aware of which song you're talking about.
So let's listen to that real quick.
there was an old woman lived on the seashore. Bow down, there was an old woman lived on the seashore. Bow and balance to me. There was an old woman lived on the seashore, and she had daughters three or four. I'll be true to my love if my love be true to me. There was a young man came courting there. Bow down, there was a young man came courting there. Bow and balance to me. There was a young man came courting there, and choice he picked the youngest fair. I'll be true to my love if my love be true to me. He bought the youngest a fine fur hat. Bow down, he bought the youngest a fine fur hat. Bow and balance to me. He bought the youngest a fine fur hat. The oldest sister didn't like that. I'll be true to my love if my love be true to me. Oh sister, let's go to seashore. Bow down, oh sister, let's go to seashore. Bow and balance to me. Oh sister, let's go to seashore and see the ships come sailing o'er. I'll be true to my love if my love be true to me.
So, Norm, maybe we can start with the text again. Can you tell us a little bit about this song?
So this is a song that goes back to England. Not sure exactly how far back, probably 17th or 18th century. And there's a murder takes place, but this is because of the jealousy of two sisters who are both in love with the same man. He shows his favors to one of them, and the one sister drowns the other one because she wants to have the she wants that man. There are different versions of it way back in when it was first emerged in the folk tradition, some indication that the man himself may have had something to do with the murder. There are also complications in the story about how when she is fished out of the water, her body is fished out of the water, or her bones are fished out, that somebody makes a musical instrument out of her bones, and then the bones automatically sing the story of what happened to the woman. In this case, the song is shows that it's really a musical version of a folktale that's still older. A lot of that does not emerge in the American version, of course. So the performer, Bradley Kincaid from Kentucky, was one of the, this was a commercial recording. He had a commercial career, but he was, he started out as a traditional non-commercial performer who then became commercial. He was very interested in folk songs when he was growing up, and he did a lot of collecting himself. So he kind of straddled the line between the commercial performer and the folklorist who was actually collecting the material. The song that he recorded here, he knew more verses to it, and you can tell he's a little rushed because of the three or so minute limitation of a 78 RPM record. Singers had to cram long ballads into, you know, they had to truncate them considerably, and he had to do that in this case.
And Carson, what do you see as being interesting about the music?
Well, this one, and it's funny because when I listen to it now, it seems very obvious. But at first, and this may have been because I was somewhat biased by other versions of this song I had heard, but I was originally, without even really thinking about it, I was going to transcribe it in 12/8. But there were a lot of rhythms that were sort of in between. Like the guitar, for example, is actually a straight eighth accompaniment, so that would have necessitated a duple eighth notation. But eventually I decided to do it in 2/4 in cut time, because it's a little more towards was an old woman lived on the seashore, and it's sort of between them, and there's sometimes when it's very leans much more towards the triplet, and sometimes where it leans much more towards the, you know, the eighths and sixteenth notes. But partly because my conception of the song was very much in a triple meter, I put this one not in a triple meter because I thought that's what made this one sound a little more distinct from the other ones.
Well, what I love about what you said about this one and the previous songs is, as you talk through these issues, you see how exacting the job of the transcriber is, and mm-hmm. How many judgment calls you really have to make when, again, you're dealing with a tradition that was never written down, and now you're trying to fix sort of in amber something that's not fixed in amber to begin with, right?
Right. I can't tell you how many times I did a transcription and then went back and looked at it and thought, wait, that's not right. That's completely wrong. You know, just heard it a different way this time. And, you know, just as many times, and the next time I listened to it, I went back to the first way. And there are times when I had disagreements with the editor where I would say I had written a note, to me it sounded like a flat seventh, and to him it sounded like the natural sixth, and you sort of have to pick your battles, you know, how strongly do you feel about it? How important is it really? It's that was the biggest frustration for me is going back and listening to songs and thinking that I had gotten it wrong and having to do it again. There was one instance where it was one of the Carter family songs. I don't remember what it was called. It's one of the last ones in the book. I remember that. I did a transcription, and then when I listened to the recording of it, it
is
was
single girl married.
Single girl married girl. That's right.
96.
Yeah, I listened to it again, and things were so wrong that I couldn't understand it. And then I finally realized that they had re-recorded the song a couple of times, and it was very close, you know, to the casual listener. But once you start getting into the weeds, you know, there are some very specific differences. And I thought I had completely lost my mind for having transcribed it so wrong.
Norm, do you think, as a folklorist yourself — I'm not a folklorist, so I don't exactly know the ways that people who study this music approach it — do you think these transcriptions will be more useful to them as scholars than the recordings in some ways, because you can look at the notes? Or, I mean, what do you see as the value to a scholar for these transcriptions, because they're going to be listening to the music as well?
That's hard to say. I think it would depend on whether the scholar who is interested in it is interested in it from the musical perspective or the textual. To me personally, not being as musically literate as other folks are, the two of you, for example, I would want the recording, because that would be much more meaningful to me. Carson's comments, you know, just about the Bradley Kincaid and about the rhythmic change, it's obvious when he pulls that out, but I would never have noticed that if I were just listening to the recording. I would have focused on the lyrics and how his version of the story is similar to or different from, say, other examples of this particular ballad. So I think, you know, what the audience will take out of this will depend on what their perspective is, what their background is.
Well, this has really been so interesting, and I'm glad we looked at some specific songs so we could get a sense of the issues that arise as you got down into the weeds, as you said, in one individual piece. But I think that we have been talking about this collection for a long time. It's an excellent connection. I hope that people will look into this repertoire more as a result of this conversation. And thank you so much for your work on this and for joining me today to talk about it.
Of course. Thanks for having us.
So This has been Kristen Turner of the New Books in Music, a podcast of the New Books Network. And I've been talking to Norm and Carson Cohen today about An American Singing Heritage: Songs from the British, Irish, American Oral Traditions as Recorded in the Early 20th Century, published by AR Editions in 2021. Thank you again for talking to me today.
Thanks.
Our pleasure. Thanks, Kristen.